Yeah, hi, Mark. You're in England. Where are you, actually?
Lewes in East Sussex, about 200 metres from a community-owned football club, Lewes FC, who play in the Ryman Premier League, which is level 7 in the English divisions.
Did they play today?
No, they should have played yesterday, but it rained. They're a non-league side. They're an amateur side, if you like, a semi-professional side. So the pitch doesn't have the maintenance that it should at a higher level. So if it rains heavily, unfortunately, the game has to be postponed.
Okay, let's come to yourself. In 1997, you published a book titled Philosophy Football. In Germany, it's available under the title Erster FC Philosophie. How did you get the idea to the book?
Well, it was 3 years on from starting the T-shirts. The website is www.philosophyfootball.com. And we found the words of some of the world's greatest philosophers on the world's greatest game, football. And I met a publisher and at a party, and I said, look, we're doing these T-shirts. He said, I know all about your T-shirts. I bought them. I love them. Albert Camus, Friedrich Nietzsche, Karl Marx, Simone de Beauvoir, Jean-Paul Sartre. What a great idea. I said, look, I've got this idea for a book. Could we use football to explain their work as philosophers? He said, I want to publish that book. And so I wrote it in about 6 months. All I did was I read philosophy non-stop for 6 months. I mean, I try to imagine what kind of footballer Nietzsche would have been, what kind of footballer Jean-Paul Sartre would have been, and then use football to explain their work. So it's a humorous book, but it's based on fact. It's using football to explain philosophy. And then I was absolutely astonished after it was published. It was translated not only into German, but into Dutch, Turkish. There's a Brazilian edition, a South Korean edition, a Japanese edition, all around the world. People seem to like the idea. And I've written and edited numerous books, but none of them have been published into, translated into sort of 11 or 12 languages. There was an Italian edition as well, if I remember correctly.
So it was a kind of success you hadn't really expected.
Yeah, I mean, I think it sort of, there was that book, Sophie's World, which kind of used children's fairy stories to explain philosophy. So there was a kind of, and there's been books using Winnie the Pooh and Bruce Lee and Muhammad Ali to explain Eastern philosophy. So there's been a sort of kind of, it's quite a trend in publishing in the late 90s of using sort of funny ideas to explain extremely complex ideas. So it kind of fitted into a groove at the time. But also, in the 90s, which I think was a sort of golden era, certainly for the English-speaking world, for some kind of football culture, football reached so many different dimensions through culture, including literature. So I think that was it fitted into that kind of groove at the time as well.
If I got you right, you really read a lot of those philosophers' books. So did you read each single one of them?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, there was a second book as well. So there was 22 philosophers whose work I had to really understand. I kind of read, what I did was, I was very disciplined, very Germanic, if you like, in terms of my approach. For 3 weeks solid, all I would do would read this philosopher. And then in the fourth week each month, I would turn them in, I would use my knowledge of football to use the football to explain their philosophy. So it kind of worked. I've got a sort of long-term idea to do it the other way round, which is to do a book of footballers and use philosophy to explain the footballers, but I haven't ever quite got round to that idea yet.
Is there a footballer who is a great philosopher?
Well, it has to be Eric Cantona. You know, he was the footballer who brought to the English game the idea that you could be as interested in Rambo, the philosopher, as Rambo, as the film star, you know, the Sylvester Stallone film. Mm. So, and he really sort of challenged people's ideas of what it meant to be a footballer. And what's been interesting is that since the end of his footballing career, he's dabbled with film. He's been very outspoken on issues of Islamophobia. He's been very outspoken on the issues of Palestine. He's worked on films, documentaries about corruption at the highest level of the game in terms of FIFA and the Brazilian World Cup. So he sort of carried that forward. Other players who would typify that in terms of the English game would be Dennis Bergkamp. But Jurgen Klinsmann as well. Jurgen Klinsmann, when he played that great season for Spurs, he was well known for sort of hanging out and sort of driving a battered old Volkswagen Beetle and hanging out with a lot of sort of off-the-wall left-field comedy stars and going to their shows and just doing his football in a very different way to the one that we were used to, if you like.
Let's stick with Eric for a while. A few weeks ago, it was the 20th anniversary of his Kung Fu Kick on a Crystal Palace supporter. And you wrote an article on this incident, headlined, Je suis Cantona. In which way do you identify with Eric?
Well, I can remember the game. It was in 95. We started the company in 94. Our first shirt was an Albert Camus shirt because Camus was both a Nobel Prize winner for literature, one of the founders of existentialism, and played in goal for Algeria. And we were sort of looking around for a footballer who would represent what we were trying to do, which was to put philosophical ideas on the front of a shirt and name and number on the back. And Cantona was the obvious candidate, and we'd produced a shirt in early February, if I remember correctly, maybe January actually. And then that week, this incident took place. Some fans have challenged me, say it wasn't live on TV. I do seem to remember it being live on TV, but it was absolutely everywhere. And he didn't simply assault a supporter. A supporter came down 11 rows back, down to the front row, a pile of racist, xenophobic abuse, which was attacking Cantona because he was French. And Cantona responded in a very dramatic fashion. I don't think anybody would defend somebody kicking out as a supporter, but he took a stand. And football's not very good at taking a stand. Certainly back in those days, he's not very good at taking a very firm stand. He took sides. Sport is about taking sides sometimes. It's not sport for all. It's not, for my mind, football shouldn't be open to racists and xenophobes and the violent. And he took a stand, and he was penalised very heavily for it. He was found guilty in a court of law. He was suspended for 6 months, which was unknown. But many fans stood by him and said, look, we want Cantona in the game. We don't want racist hooligans in the game. And so we stood by him. And 20 years later, with our tongues in our cheek, instead of Je suis Charlie Hebdo, we produced a Je suis Cantona t-shirt. And on the sleeve, it said clearly, United against racism. I'm not a Manchester United fan. But you didn't need to be a United fan in order to stand with Cantona against racism that night and ever since.
At least in Germany, I think, and England as well, racism and homophobia are still part of the game. Whether we like it or not, it's still in the stadium. What do you think is the best way for a player to deal with that?
Well, I think, first of all, what we need to remember is that racism and homophobia, xenophobia, Islamophobia, and so on, exist in society. So why should football be any different? Well, the key reason why football should be different is because, unlike the sort of 70s and 80s, our teams are so multicultural, and it absolutely defies common sense to racially abuse players on the opposite side when you've got black and brown players on your own side. And I think that's what's fundamentally challenged racism within football. But this is what I would describe as a territorial anti-racism. It's nothing really to do with embracing multiculturalism. It's about thinking, well, I'm not going to give those players a hard time because of the colour of their skin, because it might offend some of our players. So it doesn't really affect attitudes. And I think it's a societal problem. It's not something that football can do on its own, but it needs to wise up to the fact. But if it's going to take a stand against racism, there's no point issuing fines. It's about banning. It's about docking points. It's about games being forced to play behind closed doors. But at the same time, football needs to work with social forces in order to change people's attitudes. And I think what sport does in general, and football in particular, because it's such a big sport, is it opens a window of opportunity for a conversation. For people to say, well, I'm not particularly in favour of Islam, for instance, but I've noticed loads of our players are Islamic. So what's going on there? You know, particularly if they're French North Africans, they're going to be, likelihood is they're going to be Islamic. So it opens up an opportunity for people to be more engaged, if you like, with multiculturalism. But it won't solve it. Football can't do that on its own. So that's what we need. We need activity inside and outside of a stadium. So there's not, I think this is broadly true in Germany, certainly true in England, is there's not a popular movement against racism. You know, it's very much for the sort of hardcore activists, and that's where football and sport can play a key role, because it opens up a conversation. You have huge debates about national identity, I'm thinking outside of football, but in terms of London 2012, where our medals are being won over and over again by black and brown athletes. Again, it opens up a conversation when an England team is so obviously black and white. You know, our greatest ever moment, I don't want to upset your listeners, was of course 31st of July 1966, when we rather unfairly beat Germany 4-2 after extra time. We could talk about the fairness of those goals in a moment, but that was an all-white England team. It was an all-white German team. It's inconceivable that a team selected for the Euro 2016 qualifiers in a few weeks' time, either an English team or a German team, would be all-white. And that's not because either of our managers are particularly politically correct. It's because they're drawing on the best players in their league, and those leagues draw on increasingly multicultural societies. So that reflects a change, and that enables a conversation to take place, but it doesn't actually enable deep-seated attitudes to change a lot.
Is the situation which Continental and other foreign players face today in the Premier League different from the one when Cantona was still playing?
Yeah, I mean, I think football, to about 95, you know, you've got to remember only 10 years previously, all English club sides had been banned from European competition. Liverpool had been banned indefinitely from European club competition because of the outrage at the Hazel European Cup final in 85. It took 5 years until English club sides were allowed back into European competition. I think it was another year before Liverpool were allowed back in. So you were still at, you know, in terms of aftermath of that hooliganism, which scarred the game in the 1980s. I teach a course at the University of Brighton on football culture and community, and I record those games in the 80s where teams were forced to play games behind closed doors, where games were stopped, where fans lost their lives, where hundreds were arrested at those games. Now, we've not seen episodes of that sort in a long, long time in English football. But in 95, it was still a very recent memory.